what I am planning to do today is complete the discussion that just about started last time about factored temporal difference and queue learning algorithms. So where you actually represent the in this TD you represent the value function as a parameterized function, okay, of features of the state. Okay, in the queue learning, factored queue learning, you represent the queue function, which are basically sort of queue value functions, as factored, are parameterized, represent, features of the state, okay, a function of parameterized features of the state. And finally, in the policy search, essentially you directly represent the policy itself as a function of features of the, policy basically, which is supposed to tell you what action to do in a state directly, that in itself is represented as a function of features of the state. It's a parameterized function. And then in all these cases, once you have parameters, the idea is to use the learning experience to tune the parameters. Okay. And the background on this essentially is, as long as you have essentially it's like gradient descent. Okay, so if you know the form of the function, then you can, if you can compute the gradient, then you take a step in the opposite direction of the gradient. And especially if you are using linear functions, then gradient descent is easy. Okay, the more interesting part, although it's sort of, I won't do too much of it, is policy search, where in fact even getting the policy into a differentiable function is an interesting issue. Okay, about the reason, as I said last time, that one of the reasons why we will be interested in understanding policy search is, A, you're now directly, just as you have a policy evaluation which just iterates directly in the space of policies, you have policy search which just directly iterates in the, improves the policy from one place to another place. And furthermore, in cases where policies can be represented more compactly as parameterized functions than values, it turns out that policy search is actually quite useful. And one pretty famous example is this inverted flight, of the helicopter. Okay. However, it turns out that policy search has also been used in the kind of discrete problems that we are more familiar with. In particular, a planner called FPG won the 2006 International Planning Competition, the probabilistic track. Now, in fact, the interesting thing is that if you are doing planning competition, then you know that you got the entire model in front of you, right? So it's not a reinforcement learning problem at all. But I did mention to you that you can use reinforcement learning problems, reinforcement learning techniques on planning problems. So basically, don't look at the model, act as if, you use the model as a simulator. Do you understand? FPG did quite well that year. Although it's one of the very different, all other approaches basically directly use the model. This used reinforcement learning techniques, and it in fact won the competition that year, if you don't count FFRE plan, which was a baseline planner, which actually won the competition. Everybody else was, so of the losers, it was the better loser that year. But so anyway, at least there are papers which talk about how to do policy gradient search, for more discrete, problems. So that's another reason to look at that. Okay, so as I mentioned last time, large state spaces, there are two issues. One is you need to, it's very large. There is not enough training data. So in fact, first of all, there's a memory issue. You have to remember a huge value function, R Q function. And secondly, there is really not enough training data, because to learn the values in each of the cells, you basically need lots and lots of training data. Okay, at least training data which is proportional to the size of the table, because there is no obvious connection between, in your mind, about the values of neighboring cells. Of course, the Bellman equations connect them, But during the learning, exactly how do you say, if I know this number, then I also can fill something there. And so in some sense, function approximation winds up doing that. So essentially, when you compress data, this is something that we talked about when we first talked about machine learning in 471. You know, when you compress data, you also generalize it in some sense. Okay, of course, if you do lossy compression, essentially, that's when that it happens. Okay, so when you fit a function to the data, then in essence, in changing the parameters of the function, if you, let's say, based on one example, you change the parameters of the function. Last class, I was using the example of fitting lines, right, to some data. So this line basically has, you know, theta 1 x plus theta 2 y equal to theta 3, where theta is the function, the parameter. So you can think of it as y equal to mx plus c. Now, basically, you looked at one example, and that example has x value here and the y value here, but this guy is saying the y value is here. So there is an error here, and you want to reduce the error. Okay, to reduce the error, let's say you want to make this line kind of go closer like this. Okay, you could do that by changing the parameter, one of the parameters. But when you do that, you not only made it change here, you made it change for all the other guys too. You could have worsened the error on the rest of them, you could have improved the error on the rest of them. Okay, so you cannot not generalize when you have functions, you know, and you are fitting the functions. In fact, to actually make the change only here and not anywhere else, what do you need to do? You cannot deal with lines. You need very high order polynomials, very, very high order polynomials. What that then means, essentially, is you have many more parameters. If you have few parameters that you're using, then changing one of the parameters obviously affects everybody else too. Okay? So now, of course, the question, you know, this is basically background from classical, you know, classification tasks. So that's what this is saying. The number of parameters should be small compared to the number of states. If you put too many parameters, then essentially you can change just one state's value. I mean, you can change the function such that it fits one state's value correctly without affecting anything else. Okay, that would essentially mean that you're going to do overfitting. You're going to, you know, work on each state at a time. Okay, so anyway, if you have few parameters, which is actually good for us because that way we remember smaller function than the entire value function in number of cells. Okay, if you have that, then basically it would wind up having the generalization when you change them. Okay, so that's what this is saying. Okay, so now one example is think in terms of linear functions. So you're considering linear functions of features. Okay, so you, as I said last time, you decide what the features are. That's actually a feature engineering problem. You know, getting the right features is a very interesting issue in itself. There are, you know, a variety of approaches that try to do automated feature construction, but much work essentially just, you know, assumes that somebody gives you the feature. Okay, and so suppose you have a bunch of features for the states, then we'll assume that it's a linear function of the features. That means essentially that you have some sort of function like theta 0 plus theta 1 times the first function plus theta 2 times the second feature, etc. Okay, so that would be a hyperplane in the space of features. And you're trying to find the best fitting hyperplane in that feature, you know, space of features. Okay? Now the approximation accuracy is limited by the information provided by the features. That's the point I was making. So if you specify features, if you actually are thinking in terms of features X and Y, and it could well be that the curve that you have to look at is a circle. So if you're trying to find a hyperplane, it would be a very bad approximation, right? Because essentially, what kind of hyperplane can you get? You can get something like that. which means below that are positive, above that are negative. This may well be that these positives are there, but there's so many other negatives too, and those are going to be classified as positive too. Okay. However, I also said that if you can, get additional features, you know, such as you have, let's say, x square, basically x and y and square root of x y. Okay. In that space, in essence, this data would look as if, basically, this data would be linearly separable. Separable by hyperplane. Okay, now there is this idea that can we always define features that allow for perfect linear approximation? If I'm allowed to define features, is it really possible for me to come up with features such that given any data, I can find perfect linear approximation? So there should be an existence proof. Okay, the answer is yes. Why? Because suppose I have, n data points that I'm trying to classify, and data points, some are positive, some are negative, let's say. Now, of course, when you're doing value function fitting, you're not doing classification. Those of you who did machine learning, what are we doing? We're not doing classification, we're doing regression. But they're very connected, right? What happened? This guy died? He just died. Isn't that fun?
Flashing yellow light.
Oh, that basically means, I wonder what that means. This one is, this just became very primary desktop. It should. Well, I guess. Can one of you go, there's an upstairs guy, if you just tell them that this thing isn't working. Let me just try to turn this, I don't know what I can do, but, so the argument that I was making, let's see if somebody will come and fix it before, but we have to continue. The argument we are making is is it in fact possible to separate data? The one way is that you can always define the number of features to be, each feature to be a specific state. So in the case of value function, say you have 10,000 states, you assume 10,000 features. Okay? And a feature is S if you are in that state. So S15 will have 1 for the 15th feature and 0 for everybody else. S29 will have 1 for the 29th feature and 0 for everybody else. Now, in that case, it's darn clear, right, that you will be able to fit it exactly, right, because the coefficient for the 29th feature would be exactly the value of the state. So you should be able to find that coefficient. Okay, in some sense, that's what I was saying. If you have enough parameters, you can always fit one state without affecting anybody else. And the maximum number of features you will ever need when you have, I guess it's doing something and it just went away. I don't know what story is, but it seems to be non-responsive too. No, that's okay.
The light's not flashing anymore. It's green.
Oh, it's green?
Yeah, now it's green.
Yeah. Oh, maybe it'll work now. Maybe it's just your presence. Let's see.
Okay.
Because it. Okay, it's working now again.
Okay.
Oh, it's overheating, you think? Okay.
The fans are not now stopped and that came back on, so.
It's working right now, I don't know. Well, I didn't make it up. They all can tell you that. Let's see, hopefully I don't have to call you again. But we'll see how far we can go. but the point is that you will never need more features than the number of data points. Okay, this is essentially the theorem basically that says that you can always separate any data, linearly if you just keep increasing the number of features, because you will definitely be able to do it when you have as many features as the number of data points. Oftentimes, you can do it much before that. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in fact, in this particular case, you could have, so let's say there were like 10,000 points such that you know, some are inside the circle and some are outside the circle, and the outside the circle is negative, inside the circle is positive. I know for sure that in a 10,000 dimensional space, it would have been linearly separable. It also turned out that in a 3-dimensional space, it was linearly separable. In fact, if I picked the features correctly. So this one is only existence proof, okay, but you would never really want to get those as the features. You want to get better features which can, you know, do it before. Okay, so now that's what this is saying, essentially. Now, so here are some examples. You know, for example, if I have a value function, this is like a quick review of classification, or regression, essentially. So if you have a 10 here and it's a, you know, 7 by 7 grid, is there a good linear approximation? The answer is yes. You can always get a, you know, basically, I'll show you that there is a function. 10 minus x minus y would be the value for each of the states. And it's a linear function in x and y. Okay, so you can think in terms of features x and y, and it will be, there will be a linear function there. Now, however, if you have a 10 here, it becomes trickier, because previously what happened was there is like a nice symmetry. Everybody here would be slightly worse than everybody here. Okay, when you come here, it goes in circles. Actually, not circles, but in absolute value of the distance, right? And so, is there a linear approximation in terms of the features x and y? No, because essentially what happened is x and y are this finding distance from this point. What you need is finding distance from this point. You want to shift the origin here. If you shift the origin here, you can find, you know, you can find that it is linearly separable. So in particular, if I throw a new feature apart from x and y, if I also throw a new feature called the new feature is, you know, mod of 3 minus x plus mod of 3 minus y. And because this is 3-3. And so it's kind of giving you the Manhattan distance of the point. X and Y were able to give you Manhattan distance of the point from the origin. That was well related to this point. But now we need a Manhattan distance with respect to this, and if you give that, then you can essentially say, yeah, it will work. You know, it is 10, and the theta 1 and theta 2 which exist, we just ignore them. You can always add more features. There is never any reason to remove features, because in fact one of the interesting things is if you throw in irrelevant features, and if you do good, if your learning algorithm is good, it would just find that they're irrelevant. Now of course one loop will kill you if you say that. Basically it's also true that most learning algorithms will overfit. Okay, so if you give them too many features, they will find them weights. And if they find them weights, then essentially you would wind up overfitting. And so one idea would be to actually try and check which of these features are relevant by doing partial, relaxed reasoning, you know, before actually doing classification. But we won't talk about that. In this case, let's assume that if you just added this feature, then you ignore these two, just think in terms of this feature. Okay, and it would have worked. Okay, that's just a simple example, you know, if you haven't thought about regression before. Okay, and so here, for example, is you know, Pac-Man, which I never played, but apparently it's a big nice game, and I'm sure some of you are old enough to have played it. And so if you're thinking in terms of Pac-Man value function, the features could be, so here features are x and y coordinates. In chess, the features could be strength of the center, the number of pawns, etc., etc. Okay, and here the features are distance to the closest ghost, distance to the closest dot, number of ghosts, 1 over distance to the dot square, is Pac-Man in a tunnel, etc., etc. So these are the kinds of features that you are interested in. Now who made this up? You made this up. And then you asked your algorithm to find a linear fit with respect to this. Okay? So assume that these features are provided, and you know, in reinforcement learning literature, until very recently, there is some work that goes on that actually, in fact, there's work by, before I forget, there's a work by Mahadevan, who essentially argues that if you take the value function, approximate value function, and you know, find, in some sense, the SVD decomposition of it. okay, then you can basically write your, how do I say this, you could write your features in terms of the eigenvectors of the value function. Okay, so you are trying to find the correct value function, right? Now, if you know that it's approximately of a certain form, then that value function is best decomposed in terms of its eigenvectors. Any function is best decomposed in terms of its eigenvectors. So take the eigenvectors, act as if they are the features, and then find the right weights for those. So each feature would now be essentially a pseudo value function over an entire table, and he calls these proto value functions. And so how many of you know eigenspaces idea? Okay, proto value functions are eigenspaces for the value function. Okay, and so you can think of trying to assume those are the features and see if you can fit. And that's one way of just directly computing, not depending on somebody's feature. So these would be dependent on the value function that is right for that problem, except there's a chicken and egg issue here. Okay, you need to know what the value function kind of looks like before you can be sure what its eigenvectors look like. So you assume that there is some reasonable heuristic, admissible heuristic of some sort. Okay, but anything is better than just randomly made up features, because at least if you think the value is more likely to be lower here, higher here, and you generated a matrix, you know, showing that, then its eigenvalues and eigenvectors will wind up being good representations. Okay, that's the last I'm talking about that. You know, it's actually going on right now. That kind of work is going on right now. But we'll just assume, like everybody else, that features are given. All we need to do is find the weights. And now the question is, how do you find the weights? So basically, start with the initial parameter values that would have defined a certain value function over the entire space. First, we are doing TD, so we're thinking in terms of value functions, and then we'll do Q learning when we'll think in terms of Q value functions. Okay. So take an action according to the current policy, which is the current value function has, you know, corresponds to a value, right? Our policy, and then to do this, of course, you need the model. In TD, you assume there's a model. Remember that. So then update the estimated model, so, and then perform the TD update. Okay, so you actually took this action, you got this little trace, TD trace, you know, S0, S1, and then you can update the value of S0 based on the value of S1. Right, that's what we did before. Previously, we would only directly update the value of S0. What we want to do now is essentially the following. Remember, we had a function, you know, function over the features, you know, function over the features where theta are the parameters. Okay. Now, you can actually ask what is supposed to be the estimated value for S0. It'll tell you this. Okay, and then you can ask what is supposed to be the estimated value for S1 according to this function. And plus the reward should be the actual value you should have assigned to this. So this minus this is the error. You change the thetas such that the error is reduced. That's all we are doing. Okay, in the next couple of slides we point that out. So the real question is, obviously, when you do TD update, previously we were updating the value directly. Value of S0 itself was being changed by alpha times the difference between what it currently is and what it should be based on the TD update. Alpha being the learning rate, right? Now you would change each of the thetas, okay, instead of the direct function. And each of them are separately changed such that the big thing will also reduce the overall value itself will be reduced in error. My question is, how do you update the thetas? That depends on how thetas are, it depends on the theory of gradient descent. Okay? So we'll do a little quick thing, of gradient descent. I've already mentioned this. I'm showing that these slides are there in case you haven't ever thought about gradient descent before. So if you have a function of, you know, a function in terms of, you know, parameters theta 1 to theta n over some features, right, then you want to minimize f with respect to the theta values. Okay, this f for us would be the error function. Okay, if you want to minimize that, then you can find the gradient of this function at any point in the theta space. Okay, and then take a step in the opposite direction. Now this is a multivariable function, theta 1 to theta n. So you, when you differentiate, when you're talking about gradients, you're talking about partial derivatives. Okay, so in fact, normal functions only have a single, you know, variable functions, you know, f of, you know, x equal to, y equal to f of x only has a scalar gradient because essentially it's just one variable. If you have n variables, you get a vector which tells you the direction in which the change is occurring. Okay, and the projection of that vector into individual dimensions correspond to the partial derivatives. Right? So basically, vector calculus tells us that the gradient of f theta with respect to theta is just a vector of partial derivatives of the following form, dou f theta by theta 1 and, you know, all the way to theta n. Okay. So if you can compute, where, of course, you know, this is the definition of partial derivative in case you don't know. All you're saying in a partial derivative is you just change one variable, one of the parameters by an epsilon. So normally for the single variable case is fx plus h minus fx by h, where h tends to 0. Here it's f of this whole thing with ith variable increased by epsilon minus f of the original theta by the epsilon, epsilon tending to 0. That would be the partial derivative in that direction. Okay. Now if I do this thing, then once you have this vector, then you have to make a move in the direction opposite to that of the gradient, and the move should be proportional to the gradient. Okay. Now, what is the proportionality constant? The big moves will essentially can overshoot the minimum. Small moves take forever to get to the minimum. And there are all these other problems such that if you have multiple minima for this function, then you can get stuck in a local minimum. Okay. So gradient descent basically gets you to the local minimum, the closest local minimum. That's what it can do for you. Okay? So anyway, there are interesting theory about what is the best way to make these steps. And for example, in the beginning, one obvious idea is in the beginning, keep the proportionality constant high so that you make big steps. And when you come closer, make them small so that, you know, when you reach the minimum, you don't just start it by. Things like that. And many of these, if you take, you know, function optimization classes, there's good theory as to, you know, what you can say about the convergence rates, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? But we won't care about that. We'll just assume that we'll check alpha times this. In particular, it turns out that, as we'll show in the next slide, if we are talking about linear functions, then much of the complexity goes away. Essentially, for the case of linear functions, pretty much any random proportionality constant will get you to the minimum. And not only that, if you have a linear function, the error function essentially would be unimodal, and you would get to, there's only one minimum, and you'll get there. Okay, whereas if it's nonlinear function, there can be local minima, and you need to decide how to get there, etc. So there's a lot more interesting stuff in the multivariable function minimization occurs when the function is nonlinear. Okay, but we will assume we are looking for linear functions. Why? Because it's easier to do. Okay, and then also because if I am engineering the features, leave it to me, I will give you the right features such that all you need is a linear function. If you gave me features, so again, think about this, the case that I was telling you last time, if you are stuck with the feature which is the intensity, absolute intensity of the sound in the normal, you know, definition, not the log of the absolute intensity of the sound, and then you're trying to see how a value, a sound with a certain intensity and certain pitch, etc., affects the eardrums, you'll find that the function there is actually a nonlinear response function. Right? because, you know, in fact, it turns out that ear actually, eardrums are proportional to logarithm of the intensity. But if I give you the intensity, logarithm of the intensity to begin with, decibels, then you don't, then you will find it's linear. So if I just decide to measure intensity in the log units, then it's a linear function. So that's another reason why we can say we can stick to linear functions, because we are going to decide the right feature. If I did do the mistake there, then it must be because I'm supposed to change the feature. Okay, so anyway, this is basically the error between, so if you apply this theory to our value functions, then what you wind up having is, this is what is the estimated value, and this is the target value, and this is the difference between the two values, and you know, you basically square it, just so that negatives and positives both, you know, are bad errors, okay, and then that would be your error term. And there is no real reason for doing half other than the fact that if you take the derivative of x squared, it's 2x, and 2 and half cancel out. Okay. Basically, if you minimize half of the error, you also minimize the error. Right? So it doesn't make any difference. So it's normally, by convention, you think in terms of half of the error, you know, half of the squared error. So basically, the squared error of this example is this. And so after seeing the jth state, the gradient descent rule tells us that we can decrease error by updating the parameters in the following way. Theta I would be updated as theta I minus alpha, which is the learning rate. We had the same learning rate before. You don't need a new learning rate. You know, we had a learning rate times you know, the partial derivative in the ith direction. So now all you need is the partial derivative in the ith direction. Okay. Now this essentially, the error partial derivative in the ith direction using the chain rule can be taken as the partial derivative with respect to the value function and partial derivative of the value function with respect to the ith variable. No, I'm sure you remember this from your differentiation. Okay. So now in this, basically this, notice this is taking part as a x square, right? Okay, so it will be 2 times this whole thing is this part. The other question is this by this, now that the theta I is only linearly connected to the ith feature defining the value function. So that this derivative will just be that particular feature. Remember, features now are the coefficients. If you're thinking in terms of the, you know, theta space, then the features are the coefficients, right? Okay, so that's basically what you do. So this will become, you know, 2 times this quantity, and the 2 cancel out, and then this will become just the ith feature. Okay, that's what this is saying. So now, of course, normally this depends upon the form of approximator, but for the linear function, essentially, it will just become fi. Okay? So now the update essentially becomes this estimate error in the value times the ith feature times the alpha. Okay? If you do it this way, you are following the gradient descent theory. Okay? Now, the only other question is, how do I get this? Well, this one is essentially in itself, these two are thetas. These two are defined. This is defined in terms of the original theta function, and this is defined in terms of the TDR, you know, the TD update. Okay, so that's what we're going to say next. How should we get the target value of here? So basically, TD based RL starts with the initial parameter values, takes an action, updates the estimated model, and performs TD update for each parameter using this. Okay, now of course the only question is, what is the target value? What is supposed to be the target value? The target value is supposed to be what the TD update says is the target value. This is the first time we actually cared about the fact that we are not just doing normal regression, we are doing regression embedded in reinforcement learning. Do you see what I'm saying? So normally if this was just, you know, a regression, then, you know, there is an actual known value for that data. Here, what you're saying is, if you knew what should be right, if the value function is optimal to begin with, then it would have been consistent with the TD updated value. So in essence, what we're going to say is V of s is the R of s plus beta times with theta of s dash, where s dash is the second state that you saw in the TD update. And these two V thetas are basically the same theta based functions of the features of the state. Question, yes? Yes. In changing, so in essence, FIS basically, for a state S, there are, you know, n features. You know, FI is the ith feature. And if you are changing the weight for the ith feature, which is theta I, then you only care about the ith feature. Okay? This would not be normally true if, in fact, you had a nonlinear function. You know, for example, if you had, you know, theta 5 times fi, you know, f1 and f2, you know, feature 1 and feature 2, then some values, some of the updates will have multiple feature values being taken into account. Okay, so this is the only place where you're really using TD. This is the thing that makes it reinforcement learning. Okay, so in some sense, update, what you're supposed to be consistent with will be told to you at that point of time. Whereas for normal regression, when you give the data, you know what the data is, I mean, what the correct values are, at least in the training data. Okay, this is more of an online learning scenario, because as you get to a state, you know what is supposed to have been, and you do, you know, a trace, you know, one step, then you know what should have been the better value for this state, and you try to reduce that error. Now, what's interesting, of course, is we know that this is not the truly correct value. All we have is a proof saying that if you do TD updates infinitely often, then eventually the values of the states will become, will converge to their true optimal values. And we are piggybacking on that theorem and saying, since you're going to do that, in between I will be changing my theta such that they will be consistent locally. So this also means, by the way, that remember that in cases where the terminal state is far away, in the beginning you would start changing the value of a state in the wrong direction, right? Because your neighbors are just as bad as you are, because they don't know what their true value is. What that means is, in the beginning, the function approximator is approximating the wrong function correctly, right? And then as the but you don't have any allegiance to the current function. It only is as good as getting you to the next function. Okay, so as you keep doing more of these updates, eventually you will get, you will wind up actually approximating the right value. Now, the thing that I want you to understand is, much of this theory of error minimization could have made sense if I came and told you, guys, this is the V star. This is the optimal value. Okay? Can you find me a representation of V star in F theta of these five features? If you did that, you would be doing classical regression, because this is your training data for which, for each state, you know the features, you know the exact value you are supposed to fit to, and then you are essentially changing the theta. Whereas in reinforcement learning, on the other hand, I keep changing my mind as to what is supposed to be the true value. Until I actually converge, I don't know what the true value is. It's just that if I keep doing it enough, so in fact, one idea could be that you could, I could have said, just run the TD, atomic TD before, that we talked about before, until the end, get the V star, then go do this. If all you wanted was a compact representation of the value function, that would have been fine. Okay? So, I want you to think about what you are, what's the advantage of doing this inline? If in fact one variable, one guy's value you got a better estimate, you know, let's say truly better estimate. As an oracle, you realize, yeah, this guy should actually be, say, 15. He currently is saying his value is 5. To get that error reduced, you just change the theta. In doing so, you would have also changed the neighbor's values, hopefully for the better. Right? But then this is a double-edged sword. Just before that, I said in the beginning stages, TD is likely to fit to the wrong value of the state, because in the beginning stages, everybody's value is worsened because its neighbors also have the wrong values. And so when you update, your value becomes the wrong value, you know, even more wrong than before. And then you are actually, you know, you are fitting to that. So the errors are propagated, the correct things are also propagated. So if you want to see why it's a good thing, you talk about the correct things being propagated. And if you want to say why it's a bad thing, you say errors are propagated. But that's really true. That's more or less what you do in real life. I mean, I want you to realize that you are always generalizing based on the experiences that you get. Okay? Now, of course, the theory that this, in fact, will converge is ultimately based on the fact that the V converges to V star. And even if you were completely wrong all the way to then, and then you just woke up and started updating the theta value such that V star, so remember, once it converges to V star, it'll just be V star, V star, V star, V star, V star. So while you're doing more and more and more TD updates, the world waits now because the values are not changing. So you would actually fit correctly to the, you know, modulo the given features, you will fit correctly to the V star. So by that time, you would have converged. What's not obvious is I can't prove that it will be faster, because if I could be propagating my errors or I, just as much as I could be propagating my correct values. All I can say is in practice, it in fact is quite fast. I mean, nobody ever does direct values. In fact, one of the interesting things is, and this is like the mind-blowing thing, even though I told you in this class first about tabular representations of value functions and tabular representation of Q values, etc., etc., reinforcement learning, when it was first done, when it didn't even have the name reinforcement learning, it was done this way. Because this is a more natural thing you would do, because you would have to say, for example, the first reinforcement learning program is Samuel's checker playing program. What's he going to say? That there are 10 power 57 states and each of them is a feature? It makes no sense. So he had to talk about, for checkers game, some random number of features that he made up. I don't even know how checkers, you know, think. If it's chess, he would have said, like, you know, center control, etc., etc. And he would have essentially gradient descended in that space while the correct value keeps changing. That's the mind-blowing thing, right? You know, the correct value keeps changing until you reach V star. So the proof that this converges depends on the fact that the proof TD converges. And once it converges, then you would have infinite time to fit to it. And so original reinforcement learning algorithms really were doing this. But it is easier to actually understand theoretically in the way I told you. And this happens oftentimes in math also. For example, differentiation was done before, you know, the first principles definition of limits and differentiation was found. Complex numbers were used before people thought it makes actual sense to talk about properties of complex numbers. And complex numbers were used originally in the context of finding roots for a cubic equation. So this guy essentially said, here is an engineering trick. You know, make these things happen and then you will be able to finally get to the right answer. Now if you understand what that engineering trick is, it turns out what he was doing is inventing the idea of complex numbers. Okay, so that's basically what I want you to understand, that first principles of understanding of reinforcement learning is not the chronological understanding of reinforcement learning. Even though we are talking about this in the fourth class on reinforcement learning, this is how any reinforcement learning algorithm actually worked. Okay? So that's it. That's basically temporal difference-based reinforcement learning. Now, I could have essentially said this, and you would have more or less said yes. Yeah, it sort of makes sense, you know. I mean, obviously you're taking error, you're multiplying it by alpha, and, you know, I mean, in fact, one interesting thing is, if you multiply alpha times fi, it'll be yet another constant for each feature. And it turns out that if you remember the perceptron learning algorithms, in many perceptron learning algorithms, the easy implementations won't even differentiate the features. So they essentially think of this and this together as one constant. It turns out even then you will sort of converge. For linear functions, all kinds of fun things will happen. But the, you know, the real theory is this. You know, if you're doing gradient descent, this is basically what should be. It should be a, you know, value. This alpha can transcend all the parameters, but this should be, for each direction, you should consider the feature in that direction. Okay? So that's that. So now for TD, the step two requires model because you're trying to figure out what action to do. So you do Q learning. Do the exact same thing, except instead of fitting to the value functions, you fit to the Q value functions. Okay? And then when you do that, of course, in the step two, finding an exploratory or exploring, you know, exploratory or the greedy action means just pick the value, the Q value that's the highest, the action with the Q value that's the highest. And then, you know, if you're doing exploration, basically say with probability epsilon, pick that, and probability 1 minus epsilon, pick that, probability epsilon, do something else. Okay, and then everything else is the same. Essentially, wherever you had V, you now have Q. And you are now fitting to the Q values. Okay? Any questions on this stuff until now? What?
If we learn a compact representation for Q values, it removes the necessity.
Yeah, yeah, Q learning doesn't need the model at all.
Then we said that having a model helps us generalize.
Yes, not, unfortunately, I would not be teaching you. Well, policy learning kind of might come closer, but till now I haven't really, you know, this is factored approach in the model free case. This didn't particularly, you know, drive home the point that model could be useful. Because Q values are model free. Okay? Okay, so in some sense I want you to ask these kinds of questions to yourself, and especially, I mean, of course to me too, but especially to yourself, because, you know, as I said, in the class, in the 471, we did some at atomic level, some at propositional, some at relational. The question is, when you did something at atomic, is it because you don't want to do it at relational or not? You have to ask yourself that question. Similarly here, some algorithms are model free, some algorithms are model based. Is that because that's the right thing to do or not? You know, it's oftentimes it's because that's what we have algorithms for. So for example, the elementary factored reinforcement learning algorithms are model free. But now it's much more model based work. Okay? So the next thing, which is essentially, again, it's model free because you don't really care about the model. It's just you. What you do is, instead of tweaking the values, you want to tweak the policy. Now, in a way, it's surprising that we took this long to come to policy search, because in MDPs, we talked about value iteration and policy iteration right after, one after other. However, this is like the third class on the, no, fourth class on the reinforcement learning. The first three classes, I only talked about tweaking the value function. ADP tweaks the value function, right? TD learning tweaks the value function. Q learning tweaks the value function. Who has tweaked the policy till now? Nobody. Why aren't we tweaking policy? Well, we will now. Okay, so this is like, so if for MDP, value iteration, policy iteration, for reinforcement learning, all the other things we did till now fall under the value iteration essentially. And this falls under policy iteration. Okay? And, you know, as I said, I already told you that it's been used for various things. So what's the policy search problem? Often the feature-based policies that work well are not the one to approximate. So what are you interested, essentially, in solving the reinforcement learning problem? You want the optimal what? Policy. Value is the middle point. It's only means to the end. What if the end is easier than the means? You understand what I'm saying? So in fact, what if the optimal policy actually has a simpler structure than the optimal value function? In which case, trying to learn the optimal value function might be a harder learning problem than directly trying to learn the value policy function. It depends on problems. In some cases, policies are actually harder than the values. Some cases, they are easier than the values in terms of their learnability. Okay? Yes? No, but Q is actually a stand-in for the value too.
No, but
here is the interesting thing. Q is a stand-in, but in Q learning, you want not to... So yes, Q is a stand-in. But if you think it from, look at Q values from the point of view of actions, you would say Q learning has converged as soon as at each state, the optimal action has the highest Q value. But that's not what reinforcement learning would do. It will actually try to get the optimal Q value. So this is exactly the same problem that policy iteration was trying to avoid. You know, value function will try to get the optimal value function. The policy becomes optimal much before the value becomes optimal. This was the whole discussion I had last time, because all you want for the policy is the Q values have the right order. They don't have to be cardinal, they have to be ordinal. So the right comparison holds, such that the right, the best one is really the best, has the best Q value. But optimal Q value may still not be, I mean, so I got 7th action is the best action, Q7 is higher than everybody else, and it's now saying 7.0, but its actual optimal Q7 is 70.0. So you would have taken a lot more iterations to get there. Such a very good point, and essentially, in fact, we'll talk about it in a minute. You want to think in terms of Q values, ultimately. Even when you are searching in the space of policies, you want to think in terms of Q values, except you now know for sure that all you are interested in those Q values are not themselves, but the action they suggest, which is what we should have cared about before. In some sense, I would say Q learning forgot the reason it started thinking about the values. The reason you think about the values is because of the policy that you wanted to compute. And then it was trying to optimize the, you know, fit to the Q. But you really want to just optimize the fit to the, you know, policy. Okay, that's a very good point, by the way, and people should understand that. And actually, I think next slide, in fact, talks about that. The solution is learn the policy that maximizes rewards rather than the value that predicts the rewards. This is the idea basically behind policy search. Okay. Now, the simplest policy search essentially starts with an initial linear value function or Q function. Okay. In fact, you would say Q function. And then nudge each feature weight up and down to see if your policy is better than before. So you're changing the Q value such that the right guy wins, in which case you will get the right action. You are not trying to reduce the error between the Q optimal and current Q value. You're trying to make sure that you become the right action. That's the difference. So much of the machinery that we developed remains the same. If you had features to represent Q values, you still get to use them right now. Except the updates are done in terms of whether it is correct with respect to the policy. Okay? Let me show you that in a minute. So basically, you want to nudge the feature weight up and down to see if your policy is better than before. So now, to be able to do that, you want to somehow be able to descend the gradient not in the value space, but in the policy space. There's a problem there. Because for the problems we are talking about, how many policies are there? Finite number. That means they are not differentiable. Discrete functions are not differentiable. In particular, for a small change in the Q values, which is, you know, the action, the correct action will suddenly change. You know, in fact, I'll show you, you know, we'll get to it in a minute. But so here, there is a Q value, you know, for two different actions. This one is going down like this, this one is going like this for a particular theta. Right? These functions are nice and continuous. But the optimal action, on the other hand, is this. That's discontinuous. Right? Okay? Yes? Rho is the value of a policy. I'll get back to this slide in the correct order again. I'm just showing you this picture. Okay, so this is obvious to you that, in fact, you know, policies are discrete, and so which can be seen as a good thing, it can be seen as a bad thing. Discrete things can't be differentiated. Okay, so what we will wind up doing is essentially think of a continuous space of policies, weird as it might sound. And how can you get a continuous space of policies? It turns out that the thing, you know, long back when we started talking about MDPs, I mentioned the following thing, that MDPs can be sort of seen as a game against nature. Right? When you are playing games against people, you don't expect policies to be deterministic. What was the game for which you cannot have a deterministic policy? What? Which one? Rock, paper, scissors. Right? In the case of rock, paper, scissors, you needed a mixed policy. And so mixed policy, searching for the optimal mixed policy is always better than searching for the optimal deterministic policy. For normal MDPs, there is a theorem which says that if there is an optimal mixed policy, there is also an optimal deterministic policy. So you are only searching in the space of optimal deterministic policies, only searching in the space of deterministic policies. So this is one of these weird scenarios where if you could think, you know, there is a continuous function and a discrete function, they both have the same minimum. And discrete function cannot be differentiated, but continuous function can be, then you would differentiate the continuous function. So the idea that we'll use is we will basically we'll basically talk about mixed policies. So essentially the idea is, suppose you have q values for, you know, let's say there are three actions, you know, there are q values for each of the actions. You would say the q values establish the probabilities with which that action is chosen. And you will still toss a coin. So as the q values change, the probabilities that action A is being picked versus A2 versus A1 versus A2 versus A3 are changing. Since the probabilities can be changed continuously, this function is a continuous function. So you can search in the derivative. Okay? Do you see what I'm saying? So this is a cute idea, and again, it makes sense. You can run and look at what they're doing, which is what we'll do in a minute. But you can also understand why it makes sense. Why does it make sense? Because actually we knew when we got into this game that we really should have been looking for mixed policies. We were lucky that there was a theorem which said the optimal mixed policy, if there is an optimal mixed policy, there also is a deterministic policy which is also has the same value. Because of which we could search in the space of deterministic policies. But now we can go back and search in that, you know, because it's easier to find the minimum in a continuous function. Cute, I think. Okay. I know that many of you are already asleep, but this is really what is supposed to be formal reinforcement learning. You know, much of what I was doing before was easier to understand, but you need to get some of this to really do reinforcement learning. Okay, so you have to extend yourself. If you forgot now, if you slept now, and I'm being nice and I'm not waking you up, I know which of you are sleeping, because if I'm standing here, I know exactly who's sleeping. You can stand here and tell me whether you can tell or not people are sleeping. And I'm just being nice today because I know that it's a different kind of a class today, but you really need to understand this stuff. Okay, otherwise you just basically are a psychology major saying, I know approximately how reinforcement learning works. Okay. Okay, so now of course, how do I tell the policy got better? First of all, I need like a continuous space, and secondly, I need to estimate the gradient of the policy. The thing that was interesting previously was that the gradient of the value function in terms of the theta space was easy to compute. It turns out that in the policy gradient search, oftentimes the hardest first problem is just computing the gradient. Now, before going into the details, I'll say that if you don't know what the gradient is in a closed form, you can find the gradient empirically. Okay? In particular, what we'll care about is that rho that this guy was talking about. What's that rho? Rho is the value of a policy. And remember, we were differentiating policies in terms of their value, expected value. Okay? And so you would say a policy got better if its rho value increases. Yes? What? Yes. last function is I'm not sure I understand where you're going with that.
You have the true value and you have your definite value. Then I think in the previous slide we are using like a square least square law. That one is a continuous
value. That's one way of understanding, I think. I mean, in fact, I think you do that, for example, in the support vector thing where you can. Okay. No, I didn't mention that, but yeah, I think it makes sense. Okay. I would not answer it right now. You know, you come out of the class and ask me, and we can talk about it. Okay. So, no, he was essentially saying that you can understand what's going on in terms of changing the last function, which is one way of analyzing machine learning algorithms. And that's actually true. But, you know, I won't go into it. Okay. And then you can compute the empirical gradient by essentially, let's say you have a policy, which is parameterized in some theta. Okay, theta 1 to theta 10, and you want to compute the partial derivatives in each of the theta directions. Okay, so what I can do is I can take a new policy, which essentially, let's say, so I want to compute the, let's say, the ith direction partial derivative. So I take theta I, add an epsilon to it. It'll be a new policy now. It's a policy which is epsilon higher in the theta I direction than the previous one. So compute the value of this policy. How do you compute the value? The very first idea we had for computing the value of a policy is start from the initial state, do the policy for a while, add up the rewards, average them. That's the policy. Right? This is basically called empirical gradient estimation. We'll hopefully by the end of today's class at least understand that. It turns out that is like a good first step. Better steps for policy gradient is essentially realizing that, in fact, you don't even need empirical gradient. You can actually do it some part of this estimation in closed form. Okay, but I think if you understand at least empirical gradient estimation, I would be happy because you have an idea of how policy search works. Yeah, I mean, no, I'm just saying empirically estimate. So you do bunch of traces. So let me go through it piece by piece. So policy gradient, in this case, policy gradient ascent, because you're trying to increase the value of a policy instead of gradient descent, but theory is the same. Okay, let rho theta be the expected value of the policy pi theta, okay? So we assume that the policy is somehow parameterized in terms of theta. Okay, now, even as you are saying it, you know that one way is you parameterize rather q values and take the best q value. Now take parameterizing into the q values, that's continuous. Taking the best q value is not continuous. So in fact, what we will do to actually get phi theta to be continuous is to say that the q values establish the probabilities and sort of convert these into what's called Boltzmann distribution, where you essentially say the probability of taking an action is proportional to the e power q value of that action divided by the summation of e power q values of all the actions. What? Yes. So that's one way you essentially set the probability distribution. Okay, so for now, that's just going ahead one slide, but let's assume that you have a way of computing the policy, you know, as a continuous function of theta. Okay? Then let rho theta be the expected value of that policy. And what you want to do is maximize that expected value. In the other case, you are minimizing the error. Here you are maximizing the expected value. Okay? And so you are directly tweaking the policy until you reach the top of the rho theta function, which is some complex function in the space of theta. Okay, so we'll assume, of course, that for simplicity, let's assume that the way you evaluate the value of a policy, normally the expected value of a policy is, of course, based on where you start from. So you could start from different states and then add up the average reward. Okay, but we'll assume, to make it simple, that there is an initial state. Okay, so to compute that, you should say that one policy is better than another state, you just simulate from the first state, and the value of the policy for that first state is better than the value of this policy, so this is better than this. Yes?
So theta here is, so it is a feature vector, is
its theta again is, so the idea is, suppose you have a bunch of features. You use these features to approximate the Q values. So theta 1 times, you know, feature 1 plus theta 2 times feature 2 plus theta 3 times feature 3 is the Q value for S1, S and A, Q value for SA. Okay? So these thetas are, so they are the parameters, and you are changing those parameters such that the Q values would wind up having the right relative magnitudes, so that you will pick an action which will lead you to higher rho theta. Because that's what we mean by a better policy. I'm giving you a minute. Just bear with me, okay? So, if I give you a policy, you know how to compute its value, either, you know, by empirically or by, you know, by actually solving some dynamic programming equation. So our objective is to find the theta that maximizes that. Policy gradient search essentially keeps changing theta such that they are in the direction now of the gradient. Because the other one was gradient descent, this is gradient ascent, so it's in the gradient direction. Okay. Now the problem, of course, is rho theta is generally very complex, and it is rare that we can compute the closed form for the gradient of rho theta. Okay. So we will instead estimate the gradient based directly on experience. That's the idea we do in policy gradient. Okay, I said this, and I'm again saying it, in actual set. Okay, now the problem, of course, is computing and estimating the gradient of a discontinuous function can be problematic. And what we currently have is a discontinuous function. And the obvious idea is to pick the argmax Q value. Okay, and if you do that for arbitrarily small changes for theta, function changes. The action changes significantly, because of which the rho value will change. So when I said it earlier, I was just thinking in terms of actions, but actually these are rewards. These are the values, essentially. So if the action changes, the value can change in one fell swoop. Right? That's the expectation, because this guy's policy, there are only finite number of policies. Each of them have a different value. When you go from one policy to another policy, you just changed discretely. Not continuously. To avoid that, we basically convert the Q values into a distribution and say that really I'm not going to always do argmax, I'm just going to consider the current Q values are setting up the relative probabilities of picking an action. Okay? For various reasons, we'll actually pick, you could have just said Q theta by summation of all the Qs. That means if I have one simple idea for setting up a distribution is to say, if this one has value 7, 10, and 15, the first one will be picked with the probability of 7 by 7 plus 10 plus 15, second one will be picked 10 by 7 plus 10 plus 15, and so on. That would have been a distribution. There's nothing wrong with it. And that would solve my original problem, which is convert a discrete thing into a continuous thing. For reasons that will kind of become clearer when you actually go into the later steps, which I won't do in this class, but the slides are there, and if there's significant interest, I'll talk about it next class. It turns out that if you have this representation, you can avoid at least part of the empirical gradient estimation. Okay? Anyway, so I'll leave it at that for now. And so there is a distribution right now corresponding to the way the actions are being picked. And this, my friends, is a mixed policy. Right? This is a mixed policy. Because given a state, the probability that an action A will be picked is not 1 and 0. It's a number. It's a probability number. And then you have to then toss the coin. So it's a real mixed policy. And what you're now doing is finding the maximum in that mixed policy space. Okay? So the next thing is, this is the last slide that I want you to be able to understand, which I almost said it, you know, previously, but you know, you can actually look at it in a more formal fashion. So to get, remember, I want to do this. So there is some way in which the Q values are written in the theta. Pretty much you did this in the Q learning previously. Okay, now you have to actually go back and think about what's the difference between the update rule in the Q learning and the update rule here? update rule in Q-learning previously was all about gradient of the error being minimized so that the Q values will be correct. We couldn't care less about that now. What we are doing now is update rule is based on the policy value being higher. And that changes everything in terms of how many iterations you need. So the basic, if you decided that there's a certain feature space for representing Q function, you can use that here as well as in the Q learning. Here, you might very well converge faster. But you are doing it, you know, by the updating with respect to the value, the gradient of the policy value. Yes, sir.
So the form of the Q function is linear, but now it's no longer a linear function.
What? No, the Q function is linear.
But this one is not. Yeah.
What we did here is not.
Yeah.
And but it didn't matter because we are actually, in fact, this is the reason why closed form solutions are trickier here.
Yeah.
Okay? It is trickier. So I'll first understand empirical gradient estimation. And I want you to understand that this could have been done previously too. Empirical gradient estimation can be done anytime. Numerical integration can be done anytime. Numerical differentiation can be done anytime. Okay? Closed form is much better if it's available. Right? So we will understand this, and the reason you didn't do this previously was because this will be inefficient and there was a simple closed form solution. And what we basically do, but here it's a harder function, you know, whose value, harder function that you are trying to take the gradient of. You're tracking the gradient of rho. It's kind of a tricky one. Okay. However, it turns out, so we'll look at the empirical gradient in this case. Okay. And so what would you do is, if you want to get the partial gradient in, partial derivative in one particular direction, you just add an epsilon for just that theta value, recompute the value of the policy, take the difference, divided by epsilon that you added, that would give you the empirical gradient because that's giving you the slope. Okay, so basically what you're doing is to try to find the gradient of this this point right here, which is actually a tangent. You just added an epsilon and got this point and you found the line, which is not a tangent but a chord. And hopefully if it's close enough, the slopes would be the same. That's basically what we're doing. And so you could have done that previously too. We don't do it because, you know, we can avoid doing that if you have closed form. Now, what's the problem with this? The reason we don't do this is because for each of these evaluations, how do we estimate these quantities? You need the rho theta, which is the current policy's value, and the values of the n policies where each of them add an epsilon to each of the theta. Where are states here? There are no states. States are not upfront. The policies are upfront now. Okay? And so this directly tells you, rho theta would tell you what the, you know, probability distribution is for picking the action for each state. And this will give you a different probability distribution. Given each probability distribution, you want to compute the value. And to compute the value, you need to estimate empirically the values of these n plus 1 policies. Empirically estimate the value of n plus 1 policies. And you do it this way. You know, at least understanding it's easy. Okay, so for each set of parameters, simply execute the policy n trials, average the values achieved across the trials, which is what we understood as the value of a policy. Okay, this requires a total of n into n plus 1 episodes. Because there are n trials for each and there are n plus 1 policies to evaluate to get the gradient estimate. Okay. Now for stochastic environments and policies, the value of n must be relatively large to get good estimates of the true value. Okay. In fact, we want also a large number of parameters because you want to fit well. Okay, I mean if you have very few, yes you will fit, but the minimum error would still be too high. Too many, minimum error would be zero, but the generalizability would be too bad. So this is the bias variance trade-off. Okay. So basically, because the number of theta are generally going to be high, and because it takes a large number of trials to get a good sample accuracy, this could be quite costly to do. Each thing is simple, but you keep doing it for a whole bunch of time to get the, you know, gradient for one direction. And all of this is to just do one update. And you have to do this whole thing again. But understanding this is actually quite useful, because essentially you will get a new appreciation for closed form gradient descent, because this is what you would do if you don't have closed form gradient descent. So anyway, while it does work well, and this is actually the beginnings of the policy search, and this is the only thing I will teach you in the class, there are slides for slightly better versions, it does work well, but it's not obviously a particularly practical approach for large spaces because of the numbers. So the idea, better approach, is try to use the fact that the stochastic policy is actually differentiable. And it has, you know, we used, a certain, certain form, which we use basically this form. Okay, and you can use that to reduce the number of trials you need. In particular, there is a way, if you can at least read this when you go back, there is a way of just evaluating one policy and computing the gradient without having to evaluate n plus one policies.
So now you have greater
dependency on the policy. Yes. Yeah. But you have to read it. Okay. And then, you know, the question, of course, is then this is for the single step, and you can do it for the multi-step rollout of the policy. If you do that, you get to what are currently the best policy search algorithms. And I will skip over these. You know, if you read these and you want me to discuss it in next class, I will do it. We anyway ran out of time today, and you know, it may be worth for you to look at it, and if you want, I'll discuss it next class. But the version that I skipped are closer, obviously, to the state of the art of policy gradient search. And as I mentioned in the beginning of the class, there are This has been used, for example, for helicopter thing. That was a policy gradient search. And FPG, which won the competition, as I said, was using policy gradient search. Okay. And I do know for sure that FPG was actually using the policy gradient search. I will send you a copy of the paper for FPG. It was essentially using the policy gradient search for what's called AOLP, which I removed the It uses the more the nicer version, which avoids doing n plus one simulation. And one last thing I want to show you before I leave is if I can get the right thing. Okay, this is the kind of things you wind up doing. Somebody asked why take exponential. Okay, so what you wind up doing is in trying to compute the derivative here. You can write it, for example, you're trying to compute the derivative of pi theta of S0A, you can write this as pi theta S0A times this by this, so this and this will cancel out. Except now, if you take the derivative here, this is actually logarithm. Right? Okay, so essentially, if you take this, so it's like if you took the pi theta of log of this, that would be computing this quantity. Remember your chain rule differentiation. And that winds up being useful in actually computing at least part of it directly from the value of the first policy without having to compute the values of multiple policies. Okay? But the bigger issues that at least you should understand is you converted something which is discrete into continuous by thinking in terms of probabilities. And after that, it's just a question of computing the gradient. And, you know, by the way, one of the things is the reason function optimization is hard is because most of the time the functions that you're trying to optimize are not linear. That's the case here. Okay, and so in that case, computing the gradient itself is a painful thing. And so you would essentially try to estimate the gradient. And the guy who estimates the gradient faster wins the race. And if you were thinking all we needed was to substitute into a closed form function, then there is no differentiation between who wins faster, because everybody can substitute very fast. Okay? And the better versus worse algorithms for policy gradient are differentiated in terms of how efficiently you can estimate the gradient. The most efficient way is closed form, which doesn't exist. Okay, so I will stop here. I would basically, unless you ask me, and it's fine for you to ask me, I would not be coming back to reinforcement learning next class. I will go into the next topic, which I'm debating between a couple. I will let you know what it would be by Friday. Okay? Perfect.